Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre. This show is being recorded in late February 2022. Currently, the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are 419.26 parts per million, and there are 2,869 days left until the year 2030. Clock's ticking. So it turns out that climate activists, well, let me start a different way. In the United States, each state is sort of regarded as a laboratory of democracy. Each state is unique. Each state in our country is affected by climate change in its own particular way. Here in Massachusetts, we've just done a lot. We do a lot of talking, particularly on this podcast, about the politics of what's going on in Massachusetts. What legislation is there? What are the roadblocks? What are the successes? What's going on? Of course, here in New England, we're surrounded by other very important and proactive states from Connecticut, Rhode Island, Maine, New Hampshire, et cetera, because of my own sort of monofocus on Massachusetts. I thought it'd be interesting to discuss with someone from New Hampshire about what's going on in terms of climate in the Granite State of New Hampshire. And to that end, we are pleased to have with us Mr. Sam Evans Brown, who's the executive director of a nonprofit in New Hampshire called Clean Energy New Hampshire. Sam, how are you doing?
We're holding it together here in the Granite State. There's a lot of work to do.
So tell me, what is the state of climate policy, climate activism, et cetera, in the state of New Hampshire?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question, but if I were to sum it up in a sentence, it's that New Hampshire has increasingly become the hole in the donut that is New England. You know, it's funny, I saw a PowerPoint in which an energy expert at the Rocky Mountain Institute was trying to define all of the different regions and how they operate. And they had a slide for New England, and it compared us to the Ents in the Lord of the Rings, that like the Ents spend a lot of time deliberating and discussing, and then they all slowly march off together. But the one entity does not fit that stereotype is New Hampshire. We continue to sort of reject the types of climate policies that are advancing in our surrounding states.
And I would guess that's sort of a testament or a legacy of the long heritage of, I guess I would say, from a Massachusetts perspective, kind of the flinty-eyed, granite New Hampshireite personality, right? That wants to go it alone and doesn't want to hear about anything but what they're focused on.
Certainly, if you come to New Hampshire and say, hey, here's a great policy, it's what they're doing in Massachusetts, that's a terrible way to sell a policy to New Hampshire policymakers. We define ourselves in opposition to whatever is being done in Massachusetts.
Well, that's an interesting. So tell me, is from your perspective, thinking about climate in New Hampshire, is there a particular vulnerability that New Hampshire has that is different from Massachusetts? I certainly know there's a lot more skiing in New Hampshire than there is in Massachusetts.
Yeah, so I think you hit it, right? Which is that New Hampshire, our largest industrial driver, our largest section of our economy is the tourism industry, and there are lots of sort of weather dependent pieces of that, including, you know, not just the ski season, but foliage season. There's a lot of likelihood that our tourism economy will be disrupted by climate impacts. And, you know, one of the classic ones that it is not different from Massachusetts is the fact that there's an enormous amount of property tax value along New Hampshire's very short and very low seacoast. So, you know, the Hampton Beach Strip is, under every sea level rise scenario I've seen, going to be underwater by 2100.
Interesting. Yes, you're right. So New Hampshire has, from the mountains to the seas, vulnerability. So if, given the fact that you're, again, staying with the mountain metaphor, you've got an uphill battle in New Hampshire, what kinds of stuff, what are the baby steps you're trying to take, or maybe giant steps? So what's the first place you're focused on in terms of trying to move the state forward?
I would say that there is a bit of a sweet spot in New Hampshire, and it increasingly is the fact that clean energy technologies have declined in their price so dramatically that now a transition to renewable energy, I believe, is not only inevitable just on market forces alone, but should be less expensive and should save us and save New Hampshire's economy money overall. Once we've, you know, there'll be a large amount of upfront costs, but a lot of savings down the road thanks to it. And so that's, I think, where New Hampshire policymakers can hold hands and agree. And so there's a couple, you know, programs that I would point to that have me to, you know, quite optimistic about the future. One is what we call community power, and in Massachusetts is known as community choice aggregation. Which is to say the ability for municipalities to become the default energy service provider for all of their residents. And that's a new program in New Hampshire passed in 2019. The rules are being finalized now. And very soon, any community that wants to move more quickly than the state writ large on decarbonizing their energy mix can become the default energy service provider. And all of their residents can start to not only save money on their electric bills, but if through sort of smart and forward-thinking procurement strategies, the community can start to drive carbon out of the energy mix that's delivered to their residents. And so that's a perfect example of a policy that does not rely on sort of traditional, price supports like the first generation of renewable energy policies, you know, necessarily had to, but has, you know, enormous potential to reduce emissions in New Hampshire. And I would just point to, there's something called the Community Power Coalition of New Hampshire that once they launch and once they start to flow power to their residents, they have amongst their founding communities, they have 20% of New Hampshire's electric load in their communities. And that, so it's, you know, it's more than any other utility except for Eversource in the Granite State.
It's a fascinating question because the analog to that, as you said, in Massachusetts, this community choice aggregation where the town chooses where the power comes from. Do you see that, or do you think that would be then reflected in sort of grassroots, the ability in a particular town in New Hampshire to advocate for a cleaner energy supply, and that's the seed ground for grassroots activism?
In New Hampshire, I think that it will be, it already is, but I believe it will be an incredibly powerful lever for change because if you can say, hey, look at these communities, they have a cleaner energy mix than the rest of the state writ large, than the electrons delivered by the default energy service provider, but they also have a lower electric rate. I mean, you know, it's pretty hard to argue with that. Yeah. Because here in New Hampshire, I mean, the argument really has been hyper focused on what is the actual rate? What is the dollars per kilowatt hour that we are paying? So much so that it's sort of sidetracked many folks from the fact that we may have higher electric rates, but we have lower electric bills because we've managed to drive efficiency into so many of our homes and businesses. So that's one example, and another that I would point to is something that we're advocating for. It was one of the bills that I tweeted about in the thread that caught your attention, which was what we call LEPA reform, the Limited Electrical Energy Producers Act, which is just the name of the local statute here. Basically what it would do is it would create a program that would allow any generator or storage provider who's got an off-taker on the same distribution grid, right? So you've got the transmission grid, which are the high voltage poles and wires, and you've got your distribution grid, which is where the transmission grid connects. So if you are on the same low voltage distribution grid as your off-taker, you would be allowed to provide credits for the savings that you're providing system-wide on transmission and capacity payments, which both of those are charges that go into your electric bill and can be major drivers of what your electric bill is. And so what this program would do is it would align the market structures that already exist in the ISO New England markets with the you know, project developers' incentives. It would incentivize developers to develop projects that reduce regional capacity and transmission requirements, and then allow them to pass that along as savings to their customer, which could be a community choice aggregator. Again, you know, so passing savings on to residents.
Is that similar to the concept of a microgrid, you're saying? So that you're in an area with a sort of fixed local distribution system where you've tapped into the high power lines, you've got your local grid, say, in the town, and you say you would then put a solar panel in there, and then that solar panel could be used to reduce the cost locally because the power is produced locally and never touches the big high power grid that's providing the high voltage grid that's providing power into the local grid.
I would say sort of yes and no, because this program does not envisage creating, you know, when you say microgrid, often folks are imagining something that's sort of islandable, right? Mm-hmm. That if the power goes down region wide, the microgrid can continue to operate on its own. And that's not really what this is aimed at creating. It is aimed at creating more local generation that is sited in an intelligent way that will actually support reliability, you know, region wide. Mm-hmm. And it genuinely, you know, our organization has been a big supporter of policies like net metering in the past, but you know, this is something I tell to solar supporters everywhere, which is that net metering is a policy that was created because we did not have technology to do something smarter. And we do need to start thinking about what is the next generation of policies that will support the deployment of renewable generation in a way that will bolster the grid as we head into really high penetrations of renewable resource or of variable renewable resources, mm-hmm. because that will eventually start to become a challenge for the grid. I mean, we're nowhere near it being a challenge now, but at some point we need to start thinking about how to send, you know, efficient price signals so that we deploy those resources in the most cost effective way.
What comes to mind when you say I understand you. This is building local renewable energy. That presumably means local jobs, right?
One hopes, right?
And it is a way. I just think it's interesting in contrast because, as you may remember, the great state of Massachusetts had this fantasy that they were going to take Hydro-Quebec power down through power lines down through New Hampshire, and the New Hampshire voters rejected that. Then we tried to say, we're going to bring it down through Maine. The Maine voters rejected that. And you're in New Hampshire are doing actually the right thing by saying, look, we're going to build local power in our communities and we get the jobs and we get everything close to home, which is much better, to my mind, model than importing hydropower from Quebec. Does that make sense, or does that ring true, or am I off the mark there?
Yeah. Well, so what I'd say to that, you know, it's funny that you mentioned. So the project that was rejected in New Hampshire was called Northern Pass, and actually, when I was a reporter, I went and did a year long project where I went up to Northern Quebec and visited the communities that are impacted by the dams that Northern Pass would be tapping. And actually came away with a fairly nuanced understanding of those projects that they, you know, the communities that play host to them do not have uncomplicated feelings about them. They're not uniformly in opposition to Hydro-Québec's projects, nor are they uniformly opposed to them. Hydro-Québec is sort of the devil they know, and they have constant battles with them, but they also know how to work with them. And so I think that I look at studies of what it will take to decarbonize our entire economy. And I do think we will need transmission that will connect renewables from regions that have incredible renewable resources like wind power from the Midwest and wheeling that into New England. I think that will be a necessary part of how we decarbonize our economy. But when I look at how hard it is to bring those mega projects to fruition, it does make me think that there will likely be much more local generation than the economic modelers forecast, because simply it's just much easier to slap a couple solar panels on a roof than it is to build some of these mega projects. And so I think just because of human nature, we will wind up with a lot of a lot of local generation. And we should be thinking about how to create market structures that maximize it.
Fascinating. That's a very interesting point. And I take your point that these are not like, my comments about the power lines notwithstanding, right? It's sort of a broad brush. You're saying that there are nuanced issues. But let me just go one further. You're quite right that it would be wonderful to have high voltage power lines from North Dakota with wind power, bringing all that power to Chicago and New York City and Boston with some mega project. If you were based on your experience talking to people at Hydro-Québec and about that abortive power line in New Hampshire, what would be the path to make it acceptable to have one of these interstate high voltage grids? Too big a question, or is that
no? Well, it's
the head. Yeah. There's this trade-off. You need the transmission lines, but you also need the local. But how are you going to build those in the age of everyone's got a NIMBY and everyone needs a? I don't know. I mean, how would you go about it, given your experience?
I think we've got to get creative, and frankly, the mega projects, frankly, will probably have to be slightly more expensive. And an example here, that when Massachusetts issued the request for proposals that the Northern Pass project won, and then when Northern Pass was rejected, that was then transferred over to the main project, both of those were very conventional power lines that involved clearing a large amount of trees and, buying up big rights of way. In that same request for proposals, there was a very innovative project that was also considered that would have put an underwater cable down through Lake Champlain and then have it pop out on Route 4 in Vermont and interconnect to the grid at the site of the old Vermont Yankee nuclear plant that was taken offline. That proposal was rejected because it was more expensive than the two conventional power lines. But now that we've had two conventional power lines that have gone through the entire development process and rejected and now lost, 7-8 years, that proposal doesn't look so expensive anymore, does it? Right. When you consider the lost opportunity. And I think similarly, there's an opportunity to do things, and the federal government is looking at this right now with the infrastructure bill, do things like put new conductors on existing towers in existing rights of way so that you can increase the capacity rating of existing power lines. And so all of those creative solutions, I think, should be where we're spending most of our attention rather than trying to hammer through these really controversial projects. So, maybe it'll be a bit more expensive than the economic modelers who are trying to forecast the most price optimal energy transition system. But we will gain, I think, a lot of savings in just having costs that are projects that are easy to permit and can sail through the process.
Well, we blasted off from New Hampshire, and all of a sudden we're talking about mega projects crossing the country. That's an interesting connection. Let me come back to New Hampshire. So my brother lives in Nashua, right? But
Wonderful community.
Does Nashua have the same tradition of town meetings that Massachusetts does?
I mean, so many New Hampshire.
Go ahead.
Yeah, different New Hampshire communities have different government structures, and the cities have a city council and do not do town meetings. So Nashua City Council has they are the decision makers for that community. However, any town that is a town in the traditional sense of the word, which I believe is defined as having 10,000 or fewer inhabitants, tends to have a town meeting. And there are even some larger towns. So there's a town called Derry, which many people joke is the largest town in New Hampshire because it's got like 15,000 inhabitants or something like that, still has a town meeting. Mm-hmm. But so Nashua does not, but most New Hampshire communities do have town meetings.
Because, here in Massachusetts, a lot of the infiltration, shall we say, of community advocacy comes through town meetings. And back to, does that sort of mindset taken root in the town meetings in New Hampshire? And I'm guessing
what you said. In the more progressive towns. And mm-hmm. and I would say, you know, we actively engage at the local level at Clean Energy New Hampshire. I have a couple of staff whose job is to help local energy committees with their priorities and their projects and help them write grants and, you know, help them scope projects that they, you know, if they want to put solar panels on their firehouse, help them with that. Mm-hmm. And so town meeting season is a busy season for us. And we do see a lot of local warrant articles proposing a lot of local spending to advance good energy projects. And you know, one to spotlight is Oyster River, the Oyster River School District, which is in sort of the Durham area, which is where the University of New Hampshire is, recently voted for, approved, and is building, and has built at this point. The kids just moved in a couple weeks ago, New Hampshire's first net zero school, with a couple hundred kilowatts of solar on the roof and all electric heating. So local communities genuinely are in the driver's seat right now in New Hampshire, especially because the statewide political scene is pretty toxic.
So tell me, if someone wanted to get involved, right? You know, someone lives in New Hampshire or even outside of New Hampshire, but if someone wants to help out, what would they do? What's the website? Is there a website they should go to? How do they get involved?
Well, I mean, I would argue that they should all become Clean Energy New Hampshire members. We are a nonprofit that is supported by our members. Mm-hmm. So cleanenergynh.org is where I'd send you. I mean, the it's sort of a question of like, what do you want to do? Because there is so much to do. And I would say that if there are any New Hampshire folks listening right now, I think the most immediate way that you can have an impact is, does your community have an energy committee? If it doesn't, you can stand one up, find some like-minded folks and create an energy committee and start hammering at your local government. You know, do they have a plan for community power aggregation? Do they have a plan for their municipal buildings to be net zero, on an appropriate timeframe? And those are all things that local advocacy can result in. And then also that advocacy sort of flows uphill, right? So if you have all these local communities that are shouting that they want these policies for their local government, then the enabling policies that come from the state level are sort of the necessary next step. And we at Clean Energy New Hampshire try to do a lot of work convening those local energy committees and making sure that their voices are being heard at the legislature. But I think that's the most effective way to do it.
And that's just to put a fine point on it, what you just said is that if someone's in New Hampshire and they want to set up an energy committee in their town, you're there as a resource to help them figure out how to go about that, right?
We can hold their hand through the whole process. In fact, I would direct you to Josh Singer. So josh@cleanenergynh.org. That's his job.
I mean, the one of the things that in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Climate Action Network sees itself in much the same way as providing kind of a learning network and support to people starting up in town to do the right thing in their town. And so I think that's a good model. So good on you guys for having the, offering that. Wow. Well, this is a very interesting glimpse into, I wouldn't say an alternate reality, but a different take. I mean, every state has its own stuff it's going to deal with. And here you are in New Hampshire, you know, so close to Massachusetts, we're all within miles of each other. And you have a unique path that you're following and seem to be making progress, right?
I would say that the macro trends, the wind is at our back, right? Mm-hmm. Like the technology improvement is such that you'd be stupid not to go towards a clean energy economy. And not only that, I think a lot of businesses are realizing that that's the case as well. And slowly some inroads are starting to be made. You know, if you go to the New Hampshire State Senate, the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, the folks that are sitting on that committee get it, right? And even though it's a Republican dominated chamber, they get it. And you know, we've got some work to do in the House, my prediction is that 10 years from now, we will look back on the energy politics of today, and it will be a totally different world.
Interesting. Well, tell me, what I will do is put up links to some of the stuff that you've mentioned on the blog. The blog will be on the Mass Climate Action website. Just an astute listener quiz me, and I realized that if you want to get to the links on the MCAN blog, you go to massclimateaction.org. You look at the banner, you go to newsletter and more, pull that down. It says blog and podcast, and there you can get into links. And what we'll do, Sam, is put up links to climatecleanenergynh.org, right? I ask you to repeat the URL that people want to go to if they want to find out more.
That is it, cleanenergynh.org.
All one word, perfect. So that'll be on the blog on the Mass Climate Action website, and you can learn about the New Hampshire processes. If you have questions about this podcast, any ideas of things that we ought to talk about, please send an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we ought to be talking about. You're probably listening to the show on your smartphone using Stitcher, one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all your friends to listen to us on their modern podcast distribution app. And under Apple Podcasts is where's the mother load. You can find us by searching for Climate Minute, Massachusetts Climate Action Network. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. I want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, Sam, thank you so much for taking the time to chat about what's going on up in New Hampshire.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.